you know, our job is to educate, inform, I mean, and to ask tough questions. But again, we use the sort of alternatives and consequences. If you do this policy, here's what could happen. If you do this policy, here's what could happen. So that's really what we're striving for. If you give the right answer, well, you know, what's the right answer changes over time.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
AccuGut C.1 is a proven solution for your coccidiosis toolbox. Give those traditional tools a break and rotate to AccuGut C.1. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/AccuGut to learn more.
AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost poultry health and performance. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. Sid Lines, an Ecolab company, AV Prime program offers a broad range of cleaning and disinfection solutions combined with tailored advice to improve hygiene on your farm or hatchery.
Hello, this is Phil Stayer with Wisenetics, and we got Dr. Jennifer If with us for Poultry Podcast today, all the way from Kansas State. So, Dr. If you would introduce yourself to me and the audience, let's see what you're doing.
Hi, I'm Jenny Ift. I'm a professor of agricultural policy in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University. So I have teaching extension and extension responsibilities related to farm policy, risk, and finance. And three things that you really can't separate, especially in Kansas agriculture.
Okay, this is great. So tell us more about yourself and where you got your training and all that. I kind of looked at your CV and you've been all over the world, looks like.
Yeah. Well, I have roots in Central Illinois. So I grew up on my family's farm in Fairbury, Illinois. That's Livingston County, for those that might be in the know. So we had corn and beans. We also raised hogs. So I got big into showing hogs growing up. My brother is still involved in the business, but like to say is I was born in 1980, right at the beginning of the farm crisis. So my parents always said they wanted me to go to college, and I didn't listen much, but that's the one thing I listened to. I just kept going to college. I was really fortunate. I did my undergrad at University of Illinois. I had the opportunity to study at University of Cambridge under a Gates Cambridge scholarship. After that, I worked for the World Bank for 2 years, so I spent some time in East Asia. That was a very cool experience. Then I went on to do my PhD at UC Berkeley. And so that was spent 5 years out there on the West Coast. During that time, I did do some work and research in Vietnam related to the production impacts of avian influenza as well as consumer preferences. But after I graduated from my PhD, I did a complete switch to working on U.S. farm finances and policy. So I spent 3 years at the USDA Economic Research Service. Then I moved to Cornell University for 6 years, and now I'm at Kansas State University. So I'm just getting closer to home each time.
That's good. No. That's a very interesting.
Resistance affecting your coccidiosis program? AccuGut C.1 is a proven tool for your coccidiosis toolbox. AccuGut C.1 is a phytogenic formulated for poultry with plant-derived substances, including essential oils, herbs, spices, and plant extracts. Reduce the reliance on chemical coccidiostats or ionophores to build cost-effective rotation and shuttle programs. Give your traditional tools a break and rotate to AccuGut C.1. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/AccuGut to learn more.
So agricultural policy, you know, I'm a veterinarian, so I don't really, you know, I guess I deal with the results of policy, but just tell us what's your work like there at Kansas State.
Well, I teach our undergraduate agricultural policy class. I do research on the federal crop insurance program. I'm interested in farm finances as well. So looking at how less regulated lenders, so vendor finance, private lenders, what the impacts of those are. I've done some work on farm labor and energy production in the past, less of that now. I'm looking at forage production in Kansas. We have a large beef cattle sector. It's about 50 to 65% of farm receipts given or farm revenue depending on the year. So I do a lot of work on that. My outreach program, I do work on farm bill education and livestock and forage insurance education.
So tell us about that. You're educating farmers, I presume.
It's really I would say farmers. Sometimes I'm working with crop insurance agents. Sometimes it's lenders. So we do have different audiences. And sometimes it definitely is producer focused. But the farm bill changes over time. And the current farm bill, there are some choices that producers have to make on an annual basis for what kind of safety net programs they would prefer. And so those choices are affected by markets. So we do regular producer education on that. We also have this federal crop insurance program. And that is, almost all crop acreage for sort of row crops, field crops, almost all row crop acreage is enrolled at that point. There's a lot of decisions around that. And there's, they're adding a lot of add-ons, they call them endorsements to existing policies. And then for livestock producers, they're increasing the availability of different types of forage policies. And now there's livestock price insurance. So they just keep coming up with new stuff. And so I focus on what's sort of new. This is a public-private partnership. So you buy crop insurance. It doesn't feel like you're buying it from the government. You're buying it from a private insurance agent. But part of that cost is covered by the federal government. And all new policies go through a process for that that's administered by the federal government. So that's where I focus my outreach efforts.
So this is a conversation you have annually, semi-annually. How frequently do you talk to farmers and lenders?
It varies. We have like a big conference for crop insurance agents once a year, lenders once a year. We'll do webinars. Sometimes I'll go to counties and do in-person events. The audience for in-person events is really declining. And like I rarely turn down an invitation just because, one of the best conversations I had, I was doing a crop insurance meeting. And so this was, sometimes crop insurance agents will do a dinner and they'll have somebody come in. So I was doing a crop insurance meeting and they had a 7 a.m. breakfast in Western Kansas. And, it was 15 producers, but they all wanted to be there. And we talked about the political situation with the current farm bill and the crop insurance program. And it was, it was worth it. So yeah, those in-person events are harder to do. We also try really hard to have a web presence. So the webinars, I'm going to launch a podcast soon with the theme of making sense of agricultural policy. It's something that, I have had a lot of people say, can't this be simpler? And that's kind of what inspired me to do the podcast to get, there's some people that will never come to an in-person event. Maybe they're not on our mailing list. Maybe they don't use our website, but maybe they're on social media. So I want to try to engage that way to reach a broader audience. And, I get to talk to people that, about topics that I research and interest in and, again, try to make sense of them. So
with the current administration, I guess, have you seen the fallout of that yet on the farm bill or is it?
So the farm bill, it should be called a food and farm bill. I guess that's too many words. But it's about 80-85% federal nutrition programs. So the farm bill authorized funding for a major part of our broader social safety net. So that's a big part of it. There's nutrition. The other two big parts of it are the farm safety net. So that's crop insurance and then other programs authorized by the farm bill and then conservation programs. You add those up, you'll get to something like 98% of farm bill funding. And then there's the sort of 1-2%, and that's agricultural research, rural development, funds for rural governments, your extension system, the U.S. Forest Service. It is really broad. So there's a lot of public goods, I would say, things that affect the lives of especially rural Americans in that 1-2% of the farm bill. So anyway, that's the farm bill is usually done on a 5-year process. It's historically since the 60s and 70s, there's been a coalition that gets it through. So you have the legislators that are interested in the nutrition programs, which will bring in more urban legislators. It's certainly not, these programs help hungry people in rural areas too. But then, and then you have the legislators, you know, the more farm interests coming from farm states. So we had our last full farm bill in 2018, and we had extensions in 23 and 25. So the farm bill, you know, it's getting time for a update, a refresh, you'd say. And so where we're at now in the big, beautiful bill, they took part of the farm bill and increased funding for some things, and did make some updates, but it doesn't cover the entire farm bill. And so, you know, there's questions what's going to happen with this in the Senate. And if this does happen, you know, what happens to the whole farm bill process? And sort of this, you know, it's a relatively bipartisan effort. That's a big question going forward. We'll see.
So no DOGE effect on the farm bill?
Well, they did increase the safety net spending. So I guess they increased the reference prices. There's some federal programs that give payments to farmers if prices fall below a certain level. So they increase those, and they also put in an increase in federal crop insurance premium subsidy, so increasing the government share. So I'm not an expert in DOGE, but I would say increasing subsidies is not what DOGE does. So,
right. Yeah. Sounds like more, not less. Yeah.
DOGE is definitely has been at USDA and, you know, has affected some of their programs, though.
Yeah, I've heard of less travel from some of the federal employees and some restrictions on that. Yeah. But you say that's only less than 1% of what's going on in the farm bill, though.
The USDA agency that runs conservation programs, they've lost a lot of staff. There was a delay in those payments. So that has affected things. Some programs have been canceled, some were paused and then restarted. They have been getting out some disaster payments that were authorized at the end of 2024. So these are one-time disaster payments for crop producers. There's some economic loss payments that were made, and then there's going to be some natural disaster payments. Probably not so relevant to your poultry farmers, but they have been doing that at the USDA.
That was my question on the poultry side. You know, we've had disease disasters, and influenza has been a big one. We've had a hurricane come through, particularly South Georgia, and really tore up a lot of farms. And so how does the farm bill affect poultry farmers that are on a contract basis?
Right, right. So definitely is not as much as row crops. There's probably some on the animal health side. Definitely, that would be a pretty small share of spending. There could be some disaster funding that goes towards poultry farms. Again, it's a smaller share of the total. But if you're receiving it when you have a disaster, that's a big deal, right? Or if you've had a disease outbreak and you've had to do some culling. So there's definitely that part of it. I would say, I don't know the degree to which conservation funds go to poultry farms, but I'd have to imagine that some folks are taking advantage of them. You have, let's say if you're managing manure management is absolutely eligible for conservation funding.
Now, I would say that's probably the biggest overlap there would be the dry stack farm where they take the manure now after the flock has departed. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if a farm needed to upgrade the infrastructure, had some expenses with having, say, more environmentally friendly manure management, that would certainly be fall in the spirit of conservation programs.
I guess one thing I'm aware of is the influenza response. The federal government is getting more strict on releasing funds, requiring more biosecurity audits and validation of, you know, biosecurity is in place to prevent it from happening. And I think that's a good move.
Well, you think if you have insurance, right, you have to insuring something. Maybe if for crops, you'd call it good management practices. So if everybody fertilizes their field or, you know, puts up some barrier for pests that's standard, you have to do that to see the payouts. It sounds like it's kind of in line with those principles.
So as a faculty member, what kind of research do you do? What's your focus in the research?
So one part is on non-traditional or sort of less regulated finance. So I'm interested in how that affects the total amount of debt in the U.S. farm sector and the risk of that debt. So the USDA tracks farm sector debt kind of, it's been doing this, I guess, since the 60s. I'm trying to, especially ramped it up since after the 1980s farm crisis. But the USDA tracks farm debt, and most of it comes from publicly reported. You know, if you're in the farm credit system, commercial banks, they publicly report their debt volumes. But if you're, say, a vendor or a private lender, or, you know, a lender that doesn't take deposits, you might not be required to report your loan volumes. And so that's captured through survey data, which probably has some challenges of picking up that kind of debt. So, you know, so there's a sort of class of debt that, you know, shadow banking is a bit of a sensationalist term, but it's kind of along those lines where you don't really know how much is out there and how risky it is. So I'm trying to do research that sort of gets at, you know, better trying to understand what those trends are, what the risks are. So that's one area that I do a lot of research in. I've increased my work on forage insurance, trying to understand what are the impacts of that forage and livestock insurance. Interested in drought in the cattle cycle. And also one thing is hay storage. So people store hay to manage drought. And there hasn't been much economic research on that. So, if, you know, we want to try to do model drought resilience or policy impacts during a drought. I think, you know, if you don't account for how producers are already managing it, you could get things wrong. So that's one thing that I have been looking at. I also do a little bit of research on conservation practices or soil health investments on crop farms, and what are the impacts on farm profitability. So
how long have you been doing these studies? You've been at Kansas, what now, 5 years? Or
5 years. So this is my new research. So I've been working on non-traditional finance for about 10 years. The other topics, it's sort of, these are like kind of the more Kansas specific things that I've started since I've been here. So
can you say an update on, like, say, the non-traditional financing? What are you see on the trend yet, or a decade into it? And
Right. So we think, I had to pull up the report. We think the sort of individuals and others, so the non-reporting lenders, are probably underestimated in USDA debt estimates by a magnitude of 2 or 3, which suggests that, you know, right now crop farms are facing a lot of liquidity constraints, cash flow. So for, say, corn or soybean farms are paying your loans is getting difficult. People have been adding on debt. You know, there's a cover after the 80s, and farms have been adding debt since the 90s. So now we're getting at a point where it's, you know, under current farm income, under current crop prices, it's getting difficult to repay debt. And that's without accounting for this debt being underreported. So suggests the liquidity problems could be worse than what official statistics show. Definitely. A lot of reports of crop farms in stress.
The non-traditional farming then, I mean, or not the farming, but non-traditional financing. Where's that money coming from? What's the source?
There's a couple different, so there's vendor finance. So if you're buying machinery, you know, the implement dealer, you know, Deere has in-house financing, CNH does. They can provide you credit. That's really the norm when you buy machinery. That's a big source of it. Same thing when you buy inputs. You know, almost anybody that sells you something in agriculture is usually willing to finance it these days too. And so, you know, that sometimes the vendors will finance it themselves. They'll use accounts receivable like trade credit. Sometimes it's through a bank will actually provide the credit. Rabo Agrifinance, Deere Financial actually will do, John Deere Financial will do some input finance. So input finance, that's a part of it. And then you have a growing number of private lenders, Ag America, Conterra, FarmOp. You know, there's several of them. Rabobank is a private bank, so they would not publicly report their debt volumes. There's a lot of loans, private investors, you know, billions of dollars lending individuals. We have some farm level data in Kansas, and it's probably 5 to 10% of loans, it was listed as like Joe or Mom or some loan from individuals. So that happens a lot too.
And I mean, I guess in terms of somebody that's got investment money, Would that be in terms of agricultural inputs? Would that be somebody doesn't want to be in agriculture but wants to play in it, you know, so to speak?
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of interest in farmland investment as in, you know, one way, say big pension funds, investors want to invest in agriculture to diversify their portfolio or for other reasons. So, you know, you can try to buy farmland. There's some, you know, REITs out there, but that's a little bit hard to do. It's a little hard to play in farmland markets, especially if you're competing against established farmers. So, you know, sometimes you can do that. But yes, being able to invest in farm lending, you know, is a way to get some exposure to agriculture. And there's different ways to do that. You could, you know, the farm credit system sells bonds to institutional investors. So that's one way. But yeah, definitely, it is one way to invest in agriculture.
What about like cooperatives or a consumer base, you know, people that would go in and say, hey, we want to have a particular brand or whatever, and we'll support this form of agriculture? Has that got any traction in it at all?
Do you mean like, so there's a lot of cooperatives that provide inputs to farms or grain cooperatives. Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about more in the, like a grocery store cooperative?
Well, I guess I was thinking somebody, you know, had a preference to say they want to have free range chickens. And so that, you know, in terms of not necessarily profitable, if you do it on your own, you have to find a market for that. But maybe you had a consumer base in an urban area that wanted to have that as an access and were willing to pay for it. Have you seen things like that? Or not really?
Those linkages would be hard. I mean, if there's a market, you can sell some, you know, sell your products for sure. But usually the financing of production wouldn't be a part of that. There is a CSA model, community supported agriculture, where, you know, I commit to buy a box of produce from your farm every week for a certain period of the year. And so there I'm paying up front, which does sort of act like financing. I mean, it gives the farm some capital at the beginning of the year to cover their production expenses instead of getting paid after, you know, I receive the produce. So that's probably the closest thing.
Yeah, I've seen that with some friends here locally in Mississippi. They'll have a agreement with a local farmer that's, you know, got whatever they're harvesting that week, they get a box of it.
I've done that before. It's fun.
So in terms of what you're doing at K-State, you've been there for a while, and your students that you're teaching, you have graduate students with you or anybody?
Yeah, I work with usually 4 to 5 graduate students, so both master's students and PhD students. So this is a big part of what I do. You know, it's in the applied economics department like ours, it's almost like an apprenticeship. So I'm not just saying, oh, you know, go clean this data set for me. It's like, no, we're working on research projects together, and they help with my extension programming too. And they've done pretty well. I'm pretty proud of my students, and I really, really enjoy those relationships and watching them grow. And I've, you know, benefited a lot from it too.
So they usually take on one of your projects, or they generate their own project, or how does that?
Master's students, usually give them a research project, it's more like an outline instead of a recipe. So here's a question, here's a data, here's a method that I think will work. And then they can kind of figure out, you know, what they can do on their own and where they need help. So it's sort of an iterative process. PhD students, you'll kind of start out the same way. And as they get more experience, the idea is that they can generate their own ideas. Because it just takes a lot of, it's not just the technical skills. What questions do, you know, are important for management or policy? Do they have data? Have they been answered? Is it possible to say something about this? You know, we have a beer and wine economics section in agricultural economics, and some people have found a way to ask those questions. I haven't yet. Yeah. Farm tours are great, but, you know, it's like, well, what am I going to do? I don't know what I do. So you can't always answer the questions that maybe you'd like to. But you know, it takes some time to kind of figure out, build up the knowledge and experience to be able to ask the right question and implement it yourself. But that's where I want all of my PhD students to be able to get.
Naturobiologics is using cutting-edge science to dig deeper into the poultry health challenges you face. By gathering scientific evidence, they identify the most effective combinations of natural ingredients that improve animal health. Visit naturobiologics.com/poultry to see the newest research in both turkeys and chickens.
So with your position, say, within the state of Kansas, have you seen or been able to influence anything policy-wise, or the politicians come to you for inputs, particularly when it comes to farm policy?
You know, sometimes. We try to, yeah. Like, when you say influence policy, I get a little bit nervous because, you know, our job is to inform, you know,
inform.
We kind of see ourselves as public servants. That we're supposed to provide alternatives and consequences are what we talk about. So somebody used the term advocacy with me the other day, and I'm like, stop. We don't say that word. That's a bad word around here.
Maybe a resource. They use you as a resource.
You know, on your own time, that's great. But like as a, you know, someone that is an extension specialist at a land-grant university, you know, our job is to educate, inform, I mean, and to ask tough questions. But again, we use a sort of alternatives and consequences. If you do this policy, here's what could happen. If you do this policy, here's what could happen. So that's really what we're striving for. If you give the right answer, well, you know, what's the right answer changes over time.
So I guess it brings up a question in terms of outreach, you know, your extension work and really any region, whether it's Kansas or like I'm in Mississippi, different farm base and agricultural practices. I guess it behooves a farmer to talk to a policy person pretty much every year because policy could change, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And about the previous question, like I talk to our legislative, like who I'm communicating with right now, it's a lot of legislative aides. So for the Kansas representatives, I'm telling them about the work I do. You know, if we have new research or analysis, we'll send it. So there's a lot of, you know, I'm talking to folks at the Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, the commodity groups, Livestock Association, and it's really, I'm like, hey, what are you seeing? What are the problems? And then sometimes I'm pushing back information and analysis. It's very much a ongoing dialogue, I say, which is what I love about working in extension.
Now, you hit it right there. I mean, you talk, which, what I was questioning about in terms of influence or not influence, resource, and then, you know, both public, or say public, in the political sector and then in the private sector. You know, if I'm a farmer, of course, you know, you want your politicians to get all the goods they can for your state, but then at the same time, you know, you got to make wise choices what you plant for, you know, how many cycles you do, whatever. And so did you do the same thing in Cornell when you were there? Was it a different type of work in upstate?
It was similar. So the extension model was a little different there. They had a lot of regional teams. So they had regional sort of field crops and livestock teams and like specialty crops teams throughout the state. And so I would work with them. I did have a large insurance education project that I manage, but a lot of times we were kind of, the funding would pass through to them. And then we were helping them design educational programs that met the needs of their producers. So when I came to Kansas, I started doing more of the face-to-face. Well, it was COVID, so that was limited. But, you know, I went on the radio almost right away. And I, you know, I thought it was funny. Eric Atkinson, who did agriculture today for 30 or 40 years, and he retired a couple years back, but he said, you know, come and talk about these insurance programs on the radio. I said, who wants to talk about insurance on the radio? I mean, this stuff is, it's complicated. I mean, the products are complicated. There's specialized language. There's policy details. And he said, no, you can do it. I've done this a lot. Just come and we'll figure it out. And now I do it all the time. And sometimes I feel like it's a little dry or I've got too technical, but you know, you're constantly trying to like, what are the key messages that I need to pull out? You're constantly trying to get the balance of providing useful information. So if you're too high level, you don't add anything. If you get too much into the weeds, you lose people. So you're always trying to get that balance. But, you know, I go on the radio and talk about insurance, farm bill policy all the time. So I'm constantly striving to get that balance right when you go out and talk to a producer. And some people want the details, some don't. So you're always trying to figure that out.
So how do you get your services out there? Do everybody can't just know about you, or it's on the extension website? Or
yeah, well, you know, my parents in Illinois say their Kansas friends will tell them they hear me on the radio sometimes, but we don't always know who picks it up, because they put out Agriculture Today from Kansas State University, and rural radios can pick it up or not. Or I'll do it, you know, sometimes I'll do a TV interview. But right now in extension, I feel like it's a little bit of a where we got to be everything to everybody. So you got to do the in-person. We have an email list. We have a website. We're starting to do videos and social media. But you don't want to like cut back on any of those constituencies right now. So, you know, you're trying to get out with all kinds of media just to make sure you're reaching folks. And maybe that'll change in a generation. But right now, I feel like we have to really, you know, you do the in-person, you do an online version, you do the short summaries, you put the more detailed part on your website. You try to get it all out there.
So is there somebody like you in every land-grant university across the nation?
Not everyone, but there are, you know, I think a lot of the major land grants, you know, they're going to have, say, a crop marketing specialist, farm management policy, you know, they're going to cover those areas. It's going to look a little bit different everywhere.
And mostly being agricultural economics, then it would be the department that would carry that.
Yep. There is, you know, there's less than in the past, but you know, borders are less important. I think it's less in a way that makes sense. And even in our department, we don't have as many people. You always feel like you don't have enough people. I wish you could do more than you were doing. But I think it's just a part of, you know, what's been happening over time.
Well, this is fun. I mean, this is fun to hear. I mean, Wisenetics, we appreciate meeting with you, Jenny, and hearing what you're doing and what's available. And I think that's something I've not been really responding to. You know, I'm part of production agriculture, but with chickens, and it's just a different model. You know, the risk is not quite the same as it is with crop farming. But
there is one crop insurance thing I'd like to tell you about, if you don't mind. It may be relevant to some of your folks with smaller flocks, backyard flocks. Is that how you say it?
It could be.
So I don't know of a single like standalone poultry insurance product, but there is one thing that's called whole farm revenue protection. And then they have a micro insurance version of it. And this is relatively new, and it was designed for sort of more sustainable, diversified local food producers. So again, if you're doing, you know, small backyard or just small scale commercial operation, it could go under this whole farm policy. And, you know, it's revenue insurance. So if revenue insurance is something you need for risk management, it is a very good value. It's a little bit of an effort to get the first policy written. And you do have to have 3 years of Schedule F, at least 3 years of Schedule F records. But it is something, and the USDA has done a lot of job. A lot of work at trying to get increase awareness of this policy, but you know, it's in some places people use it quite a bit.
So this would be in face of, you know, your current events, you know, high path of avian influenza. If somebody had a small flock, they're not covered with a corporate contract, then that would be a product they might be interested in.
Yeah, it covers revenue risks. So if you have a yield loss, you'd have to double check the terms to make sure disease is covered. But I know, I mean, crop diseases are covered, so why wouldn't poultry diseases be covered in theory? So, I mean, yeah, that's definitely something that they could look into.
So that you would say contact you or contact the local extension?
Well, I think if you just put into Google or AI, whole farm revenue protection or whole farm revenue protection microinsurance, you'll find a lot of resources on the web. I love getting calls and emails, so sure, call me and local you know, local extension educators are a great resource, and they're kind of there to put you in touch with people. You can contact a local crop insurance agent. So there are a lot of resources out there.
That's great to hear. good to hear your work too. Again, I've benefited from extension myself and, you know, other avenues. So it's good to hear on this. I'm not a farmer, but I've worked with farmers. So yes.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boehringer Ingelheim. Health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International. Creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Making life easier for animals and those who care for them is the mission of Jeffo. Join the Poultry Science Association at our inaugural PSA Pacific Rim Scientific Conference, October 13th through 16th in Macau, China, to explore groundbreaking symposia and hear the latest research impacting the global poultry industry. Here is your chance to present your latest work, recruit future leaders, and network with other experts in the field. Help us shape the future of poultry science. Register now at poultryscience.org. See you in Macau.
Well, Dr. Iff, we got a few more questions to ask of you. It's been a great session. But these are now more personal questions.
All right.
Okay, so what resource or book do you use professionally? What's something that you would say would be more or less your Bible of what you do? Policy.
So I use two things, not books. Congressional Research Service reports. So they're an amazing, I use them in my teaching. The Congressional Research Service is to inform members of Congress and their staff. They're incredibly clear writers. So if I want to understand a policy and I know nothing, I really hope there's a CRS report available, because that's going to get me up to speed pretty quickly. Clear writing and focused, concise. So that's an incredible resource. The other thing is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They have an economic research service. I worked there for 3 years. And, if I want to understand a policy issue, it's like, oh, man, I hope there's an ERS report on it, because they'll go in depth, and it's very data driven, very objective analysis. They put out a family farms report that describes the structure of U.S. agriculture every year. And there's some things in there that, I test my ag policy students, and I'm like, you got to know the basic statistics about the sector you're making policy for. Because, in the U.S., a farm is any operation that has the potential for $1,000 worth of sales.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, you could have one calf today. You know what, cattle prices are not, right? One calf, half a calf, I don't know. And so, yeah, half a calf.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And then you say, oh, well, all these farms are losing money. Well, they're incredibly small. Like half of them have, agriculture is not how they earn their livelihood. So, understanding what we call a farm and what those farm statistics mean, is something I really drill into my student. But if there weren't those kind of like reports out there to understand what's going on and, just those basic statistics, what you get in the census of agriculture, it'd be hard to teach ag policy, and a lot of businesses use them too. So
that's an annual report. Both of those are annual reports.
Yep. They have a 2024 family farms report. I got to update my class notes in a couple months with that one.
It'd be probably something you tell your students, but what does it take to be successful, particularly in your field? What do you view some measures of success for the next generation?
I'm in a very narrow and specialized field. And we are constantly being evaluated, and like peer review, it just putting yourself out there. And so it's, even when you're successful, sometimes you feel like you could have done better. You have more to do. But I think that like that kind of striving, to take that and sort of use it, is really important. I think I haven't always known my place, which can be bad, but I think, you know, trying to expand your network and don't sell yourself short on what you can do. That's pretty big. You know, the sort of, if you don't have the knowledge and technical skills are necessary, but not sufficient, even in research and academia, you know, being able to network and form relationships and show leadership is such a big part of it. Now, if you don't know anything, people are hopefully going to catch on sooner or later. But you know, that sort of value of networks, that's so important too.
Yeah, they told us in veterinary medicine, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
You know, it's patient care, but still it's the same thing. You got to be a person, right? You can be a scientist, but you got to be a person too.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's good counsel. Well, thank you so much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.